Excellent. Okay, so I thought I would talk to you by overviewing things like the cloud and what the cloud is, kind of setting some common terms, talk about Azure and how we do Azure a little bit. I'll be here all day, so as questions and things come up, I'd be happy to talk to you and go further in depth to it. One of my roles, and I think all of us have this same role, which is to look at the future and see what technologies are coming. Right? So does it make sense for us to start to hone up our skills on virtualization or on cloud or that kind of stuff? And so I'm not always good at this. I actually worked for a company called Novell back in the 90s and in 2000. So Novell was a nice networking company. I was talking to some guys in the advanced research division that build all the new cool stuff, and they were talking to me, and I had an Austin Powers moment. So to understand the Austin Powers moment, you might have to have seen the movie, but Dr. Evil was talking to his evil henchmen, and one of the things that they were talking about was a laser beam, right? We all know what a laser beam is, but back when he was frozen, he didn't. So I was talking to these guys, and they were talking about the Itanium chip, right? Because we ran on Intel i86, 32-bit, and that's what Windows ran on, that's what everything ran on. Everything was moving to the Itanium chip. Anybody remember that besides me? Good. Some of you are my age. Good. So this Itanium chip was going to take over the world. Even HP gave up their chip business. They used to make the HP PA RISC chip. They gave that stuff over to Intel to partner with them because this was taking over the world. At Novell, we were going, all right, we got to do something because NetWare is going to be gone. We're going to be, you know, inconsequential. They figured that out correctly. We figured that out correctly, right? But one of the things that the guys were talking about is, you know what we should build is this thing called a hypervisor. Because when Itanium ships on servers, it's going to have this thing built into the BIOS called a hypervisor, which I'm sure we all know what that is today, but at the time I didn't. And they said, so you'll be able to run on this server, you'll be able to run NetWare next to Windows, next to Unix, next to Linux. And my thought of that was, who the hell would want to do that? Anyway, Novell didn't build it, and even if they did, they'd still be inconsequential probably because, you know, all of a sudden AMD in 2000, I think it was, released x86 extensions to the x64 extensions to the x86 chip, right? So, and now we all live in this 64-bit world, but still built on the x86 original processor. So anyway, my point is I'm not always good at forward thinking, but I try. And certainly it helps our backgrounds to look at that future. For example, the iPhone, right? Released in, 2007? And it's changed the world. It's not even 10 years yet. And I don't think any of us can understand what it would be like to suffer without a handheld PC anymore, right? Whether it's directions to here, it's just how I found the place today, or so many other things. So as we look at this stuff, what's really interesting is technology is changing crazily right now. It's hard to stay up on all the Microsoft stuff. It's hard to stay up on all the open source stuff, which is even bigger. It's hard to stay up on what's going on in technology. And so that's great for us, because no one can, and so they need us, which is awesome. But it's also a fun time to be in technology. One of those trends that's easy to see now is this cloud. And I'm going to define it a little bit more because cloud isn't just being on the internet, right? At least in my definition of it. But, you know, from the mobile to the social aspect, which is still evolving, cloud is still evolving. As a matter of fact, Azure revs every 3 weeks. There's a new piece of code that's added to it, or multiple pieces of code. I've had situations back when Azure was first starting, maybe 3 years ago it was, where I would go to demo, and I would test my demo the night before, and then the day of I went to demo, and things changed. That's, you know, it doesn't change as much as that, but then I'm in front of a crowd trying to show them affinity groups, and they weren't where they were supposed to be, and they were buried somewhere else. And now affinity groups are actually kind of gone, right? We've moved beyond that stuff, and we're doing ARM-based or Azure Resource Managed templates based on JSON files and all this other stuff, which is really kind of cool. You'll hear more about it later today, but just as a spoiler, one of the things that I saw in a really neat demo was building 40 servers. They did it with PowerShell scripts based on the old service managed stuff in Azure, and it took about an hour. He started at the beginning of his talk, and then at the 45 minutes into his talk, the script was still running, creating servers. And then he built 40 servers off of a JSON file with this ARM-based stuff. And 5 minutes later, he had 40 servers. And the PowerShell script was still building. So there's some really neat stuff in the newer technology that we're putting in Azure. But the world of information around us, another thing is IoT. I don't know if you guys have been looking at IoT, but you can just see we're at the cusp of that. We're going to have integrated little tiny computers in everything. And you may even come up with a really cool idea and build it, or with a $5 computer or a $20 computer or whatever, and have some new interesting thing that we'll all be using in another 5 years. And it can be just like the iPhone, where it will change the world. There were smartphones before that, right? They just all sucked. And they didn't use capacitive touch. It really changed the world. And another thing that changed the world was Salesforce. They showed that cloud computing as a software as a service does work. Somebody in here may build the next IoT thing. So there's all kinds of interesting, fun stuff and changing. So now I'm going to go back to define what is cloud. When I talk about cloud, I'm talking about hyperscale cloud. I'm talking about whether it's internal or external. I'm talking about able to add servers on the fly when you want to. This elasticity of being able to build things and rip things down. So it's going to be something you can build on as a foundation. It's going to be something on-demand resources. I found this last week. It was basically on LinkedIn. And I have a link in the notes if you want to look at it more. But I found it really interesting. It was a graphic that talked about what's the difference between on-premises and cloud computing. And it kind of says, software licenses for on-premises are 9%, and in cloud computing, 68% is the subscription fee. And then it talks about, the hardware beneath it, the training, the maintenance, the patching, all that kind of stuff, and looked at it from a cost perspective. It was interesting because it was thought-provoking. What was more interesting to me was the comments, and here's two of the comments. The first comment is that this is a great conversation starter, and I thought it was, because it doesn't explain everything in that type of computing. But he talks about, think about it from a on-premises side as well, because you can do cloud on-premises. But when you do cloud on-premises, what you're doing is you're using technologies and we'd like you to use Azure Stack, which isn't released yet, but basically we're taking all of our technology that we build Azure with, and we're releasing that so you can use the exact same code. Now you're going to want to have a couple racks of servers, and it's not for the small business, but you'll be able to build the exact same thing, and you'll be able to move workloads. It'll just be in the interface, if you wish it to, another data center looking just like Microsoft's multiple data centers. It'll be another one to choose from to apply your stuff to. But anyway, the other comment here is from a different guy who talks about, it's a very interesting conversation, kind of different way to look at it. And, he looks at it from doing on-premises things, and he goes, this is probably more of a hybrid idea. Well, that's what I think. And that's what Microsoft's looking for, is our unique thing here is we're doing a hybrid cloud where you can run it internal on your own servers, you can run it external. Wherever it makes sense, there may be things that are less expensive to do internal. Or there may be other reasons, compliance, et cetera, that you want to do internal. So a hybrid cloud is, if I can hit the right button, a hybrid cloud is the place where Microsoft looks at going forward in the future. And so if we look at cloud, there's a couple different things in there. There's different computing models, IaaS, PaaS, and SaaS. You may have heard these. I'm going to go through these painfully in case you haven't. So hopefully you haven't heard these, because otherwise you'll be like, I know this. IaaS, infrastructure as a service, right? That is the traditional thing where you provision a server or some hardware. You have to manage the patches. You have to manage everything within there. And so it's basically, you don't have to rack and stack it anymore, and that's it. It's kind of like Rackspace type stuff, traditional Rackspace. PaaS, platform as a service. This is where Microsoft thinks the future is. This is where Google thinks the future is. As a matter of fact, Microsoft and Google, when we built our clouds, we both built PaaS environments, or platforms as a service environments. Then what we saw was, you all bought IaaS services from Amazon. And we had one of those oh shoot moments, and we all built IaaS into built IaaS into our offering. So Azure has IaaS now as of 3 years ago because what customers spent money on. They spent a lot of money on infrastructure. Why would you do that when PaaS is so much better? Because you don't have any PaaS apps, right? How many people run a PaaS app today? A couple. And that's the thing is, how many people run all this code that's been built for years and years? Everybody. So the thing is you need somewhere to run that. That's why infrastructure as a service makes sense. But think about it long term. PaaS and SaaS are the places that you're going to want to be. And if we go to SaaS, software as a service, that's things like Salesforce.com, where you basically give them money, you have a license, and then you put your data in there, and you read your data out, you run reports, but you don't have to back it up. You have to do the authorizations, the user accounts, IDs, what they have rights to, and that's pretty much it, right? And then manage the data. So, looking at this further, this is what a slide I like to look at, and I know it's going to be an eye chart for those in the back, but this breaks up the IaaS, PaaS, and SaaS for me. You got on-premises where you do everything, heating, cooling, power into the building, all that stuff, plus storage, networking, compute, all the way up to manage the applications and who has access. When you do infrastructure as a service, you basically get the OS on up. When you get platform as a service, you basically run just the applications. Applications, you do have vendor lock-in with PaaS, kind of, in that you write to an API set. In Azure, the PaaS app is an API set, and then you can run it on-premises or somebody that runs our runtime, but it's our runtime, right? You can't just go run it on Google's PaaS environment. Same thing for Google's, right? Google's PaaS environment, same thing for Salesforce. Salesforce has a PaaS API set, too. You can write apps to their environment and run on their cloud. But it's not portable. That's the downside. The upside is tons of cool stuff, such as all the connections are stateless, which means if I have three front-end servers and two of them die, I as an end user keep working seamlessly and don't have a sync. I don't even know what happened, right? That if I have things that start to need to scale up, they automatically will add servers or can automatically add servers seamlessly to the back end. And so that's what PaaS can give you automatically, which is great. And then the other thing, software as a service, it's interesting that these are up here because I'm going to use an example of CRM. Microsoft CRM versus Salesforce CRM. They're both offered as software as a service, so you can just give the companies money and they give you the service, you hit it from a web browser and you have it. But Microsoft CRM is built with the traditional type of app, right? It's built on I install a SQL box, I install some other servers, I may install front-end servers, so three-tier architecture. But if I want to update code, I've got to wait for a holiday, a weekend, or there's going to be downtime. The really cool thing about PaaS is you can update code right in the middle of the day. And you can see the analytics, and you can roll back the code right in the middle of the day while customers are working in it, which is fantastic, right? As opposed to weekend and holiday work, which kind of aren't as much fun. So Microsoft runs it with a traditional infrastructure as a service model. Salesforce runs it with, I'm not selling Salesforce here, but Salesforce runs it with PaaS, right? From an end user perspective, it's the same. But from the company that manages it, Microsoft's got to do a whole lot more work to keep up our CRM product, to update it and do all that kind of stuff, than Salesforce has to, because they're using a PaaS application on the background, even though they're both offering SaaS. So it's kind of interesting because behind SaaS is one of these two models. And Microsoft will be at some point changing to a PaaS model for our CRM. So does that give you ideas that you haven't thought of before? For some of you anyway, hopefully? So the other thing when we look at these on-premise IaaS, PaaS, and SaaS is the stuff we do as workers, right? We saw it in the other box, but here's, from data classification, you have to do that. That's the customer's risk. But from a physical security, on-premises, you have to worry about that. In all of these models, you don't have to worry about it. So it changes the things you look at and worry about. So that's an interesting thing in the aspect of it. Who's not seen Azure before? Everybody's set up a VM and stuff? Everybody has.
All right, well, my demo is going to be boring for you, I think, but I'm going to go into it anyway.
because I was going to, but I'll make it quicker. I'm just going to real quick go into my Azure portal. If you've all seen the Azure portal before, mm-hmm. Tons of different services in here. If I want to create a new VM, I hit new, I choose a virtual machine. There's all kinds of other services I can create. Here I'm going to create a Windows Server 2012 R2 box.
So can I choose. Can you say about that just real quick?
Yeah.
The old app, I create a VM in the
yep. In the old portal.
And now it's called the classic or older.
It's a classic, yep, a services managed or classic.
Is there any way to upgrade that to the
Yeah, so they're working on a seamless upgrade process, and so there are ways to upgrade from the old classic and have them moved to the new one.
Okay.
They're going to happen automatically at some point if you don't do anything, but we do, we're creating tools to basically move that stuff.
So I shouldn't worry about it. Okay, good.
Well, it's something to worry about, but yeah, it's they're going to move automatically. And when we move to those, the difference between ARM and Classic is a ton of things, such as we can do role-based administration, and each component is now individual, right? It makes it more difficult. I saw somebody online complaining the other day, now when I delete my VM, I have to go find the disks, the VHDs, and delete those separately, where the old portal used to do it for me. You can delete a resource group, and that will delete everything in the resource group. But you want to be careful that you don't put like your storage in there if you don't want to delete your storage, because it'll delete everything. But it'll move to it. There's tools right now, and it'll move automatically at some point.
Okay.
But there will be downtime, I think.
Yes.
It's not going to move without downtime. But they will make it move with very little downtime. So yes, it is something to worry about. All right. So I'm going to create a server here, and this is actually doing it in the portal. It's doing an ARM, so it's going to use a JSON template underneath. But I give it a name. Let's call this Azure Day. Give it a name, go to password. And then assign it to a resource group. I either create a new one, which is easy for me. I create a new one. Now when I delete that group, I'll get rid of everything because this is just a quick demo. I don't want to keep it. Then I choose a location of where I want to put it, right? Mm-hmm. So I've got all kinds of locations, 19 of them around the world. Actually, that list isn't that big because it's my other account. But let's put it in central US. I say OK. It asks, what size do I want? In the size, I have these to choose from where I can view more. From a sizing perspective, right, I've got the SSDs or DS ones. I've got G-series ones that I can't afford, but you've got servers that are like this one here, 32 cores, 440 gig of RAM, 64 disks, but cost me $6,400 a month. I think I'll stick back with, I could go with an A0, which is going to cost me $13.39 a month, a little bit more in my price range, but I'm just going to create here a DS1, which is a pretty good, has a single core, and $63 a month. So I'll select that. I can set up networks and all that kind of stuff and storage areas. I'm just going to take the default here and create all brand new stuff. If I wanted to connect servers together and have them talk without going over the internet, I would create networks and put them all in there. And then I say OK.
Hey, Brian, just talking to
me. That would be a problem. So now I just created this. It's deploying it. And in 5 minutes, I'll have a new server up and running. So nice, it's on demand. We've got millions of servers waiting for you to use, so that's a nice thing. If I already RDP'd into a box I already put up, and so I have a server running here that I actually installed Chrome onto. This is a Server 2012 R2 box, and so I'm remote controlled into it over my little Wi-Fi here. But when I go into this box here, I'm going to do a speed test, and let's see if the Bing speed test doesn't come up. All right. I'm going to do it from basically this speedtest.net. I'll test it again. But if we see the speeds, you saw the spoiler already. Last time I had 300 and some download megabits per second download and 200 megabits per second upload. That's really nicely connected to the internet, right? And I can even get it faster if I pay for a bigger server.
I can, because these are throttled network connections. These, our network is very well connected. And so if you want to put up a server and serve things up, 200 megabit upload speeds are kind of nice. Download speeds are nice too. If you want to, you know, put up some kind of website that can handle, like healthcare.gov, you can do it. You don't have to be extremely rich. You don't have to buy, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars of servers. You can basically go here and put up, and you pay per minute. So if you want a denial of service, your friends, you know, they put a website on their home server. You can basically lock up that server because you can flood that, right? You got all kinds of bandwidth here. So this is fun stuff for infrastructure guys, and that's what I am. So anyway, I like to show it because that's just VMs. But that's a big deal. It's huge. And there's hundreds of other services here that we can play with. All right. So hopefully, it sounds like everybody in here has played with it, which is new to me. Usually I go in and 80% of people haven't played with the stuff inside Azure. So it's great to see people that have used it. If we look at compute, on-demand resources, right? That's one of the things that we have here is in this hyperscale cloud, we have tons of servers that are sitting there to go grab. If we think about what this enables for us, there's a lot of different things of use case scenarios where this is kind of nice. If I have periods where I don't need a server, I can turn it off. I don't have to have it on, right? So when I turn it off, I stop paying for that, which is great. You can't do that with traditional hardware, right? You buy the server, and it takes you probably 3 weeks or 3 months to get that thing racked and get it up and ready to use. And then you have it, and you got to pay for it. Here, it takes me 5 minutes to put up a server, and then when I want to, I turn the server off. And so if I have reasons to turn it off, I can save money. What about growing fast? Do you guys remember, I like to use the analogy of Toys R Us. You guys remember Toys R Us, was it 2004 time frame? When it drove everybody to their website, it was like this buying on the web was a new thing for Christmas. And they did a great job of getting us to go to their website. And what happened? Millions of us went, and their servers toppled because they couldn't handle the load. It was a denial of service from real customers just trying to buy toys. And so they were down for over a week because at the time, they were running on their own servers. They had to call up their rep and go, oh my God, get us servers now. It took them about a week to get new servers in, installed, up and running, so that they could handle the load of people that continually kept trying to go there going, the site's not up yet, and kept hitting, you know, refresh, which kept bringing their servers down. This, you can handle it. You know, in PaaS, we can handle it real easy by scaling out automatically, but even in infrastructure, you just spin up more servers, and you load balance across them. So growing fast, no problem. How about unpredictable bursting? You know, in PaaS, you get that unpredictable bursting, it'll automatically add servers for you. In a regular infrastructure environment, you have to monitor it yourself, your beeper has to go off, and you have to go, you know, turn on another server. It's best to have one sitting there waiting so you can turn it on and have it ready to go right away as opposed to having to provision it, add your files, and all that kind of stuff. But unpredictable bursting can be handled, and even predictable bursting, it can lower your cost. As a matter of fact, if you think about if you were going to build, you know, the next Facebook or that kind of, you know, a great one is Netflix, right? If you're going to go build some company, you have this great idea, would you build your own data centers and do it, get all kinds of investment, or would you throw it in somebody's cloud? I'd throw it in somebody's cloud. I might throw it in two people's clouds. That way, I have fault tolerance on if Azure fails or if Amazon fails. I probably shouldn't tell you that. I should probably just put it in Microsoft stuff, but I'm not a sales guy, so I would actually put it both. When we do these hyperscale clouds, everybody in this market is trying to do things to basically reduce costs. I mean, there's things that, you know, maybe other niche players are going to do that give you an EMC SAN or some other thing, but those are expensive. What we do is we do everything commodity-based. We're building our SANs out of servers that we run Server 2012 on, and we basically make that into a SAN by hosting it, you know, with storage spaces. That's all abstracted from you, but my point is everything that we put into our data centers
is cheap commodity hardware. And it's actually not the latest and greatest CPU from Intel. We do a rev back on our best, biggest servers. We don't do the latest because the latest is really expensive. And we're doing it as inexpensive as possible. If you look at the different servers, you'll see, you know, third-gen Xeon CPUs in those servers. You'll see AMD CPUs in other servers. When AMD was faster than Intel, we were doing AMD. That was the first servers in Azure. Now Intel surpassed them, and now we're doing all Xeons. But if we look at the other things we do here, building a data center with raised floor and all that traditional stuff and running at 60, 70 degrees, that's really expensive. We found ways to get rid of that expense. So as we moved, you know, on our data centers, we had Gen 1 data centers. We're now in Gen 4 data centers. We're working on Gen 5. And they're modular containers. You have a shipping container dropped off, and inside that container is 2,000 to 3,000 racked servers. We don't go inside the container. We hook up power to the outside of the container, and we hook up network to the outside of the container. In some locations, we hook up cooling as well. In other locations, the chillers are bolted to the side of the container, and we don't even do that. We also will run those data center containers up to 90 degrees. But I thought that was a bad thing to run hotter servers, isn't it? In our studies, we found running them up to 100 degrees raises failure rates just a little bit. But the cost of replacing hardware was really cheap compared to the cost of running an air conditioner and cooling that down to 60 or 70 degrees. So we save a lot of money by running it at 90 degrees. And we treat that hardware as just commodity stuff anyway. It fails, we mark it bad, and move to another. And then when, you know, I think it's like over half of that container, two-thirds of the container have failed servers, we just have a brand new container brought in and pull that container out. So interesting idea, these modular packs. You can certainly buy them yourselves. Expensive, but because there's 3,000 servers in them. But it's an open standard. Anybody can get it. HP, Dell provide it. Others will as well. And we put them all over the world. We went from 2 years to build a data center with the subfloor stuff down to a year. We went from $2 million per data center cost down to $1 million per data center per cost. We've got 100 plus data centers around the world. We've got 19 online locations for customers to use. We've got a GovCloud as well that, you know, for government that has special things that they can only have government in. So if you're in government or work with government entities, there's special clouds for them. If they need that from a compliance perspective, it is a really robust network. When you keep traffic inside Microsoft's network, we now encrypt that with perfect forward security because we found out that some governments were tapping into that. When you go out to the internet, we've got really well-connected internet connections. But if you want to connect between your data centers, between your servers inside Azure, you can keep that inside our network and never touch the actual internet as well. And so we've got great links between the continents and all over the place. Why would you want to do this? Why would you want servers in Europe? The speed of light. The speed of light's a limit. You're going to have latency because it's such a long distance, and the fastest we can move data right now is governed by the speed of light. And so if I'm going to sell stuff to people in Europe, what do you guys do when you go to a web page? How much time do you give it to load? Amazon, when you go shop. If it takes 7 seconds, are you going to wait for that to load?
Refresh.
Something wrong. Yeah. We hate waiting for computers, mm-hmm. as we should. But if a web page doesn't load in a second and a half, usually customers go somewhere else. And so that latency, as you start to do dynamic things and baskets for checkout and all that kind of stuff, you need it quick. And the faster it is, the more stronger you feel that company behind there is, don't you? Mm-hmm. Like if you're buying something, I'm going to go buy something for $1,000 and I'm doing it online. If that web page, you know, when I'm buying it, starts to take 3, 4, 5 seconds to load, I'm going, oh, I don't know, how good is this company? If it loads back in a half a second, I'm going, yeah, they know what they're doing. They got their ball on it, right? It works. So that's really important to get close for that. The other thing is fault tolerance and that kind of stuff. When we do data centers as far as storage goes, each data center, when we have data, we by default are going to store 6 copies of your data. We mirror it across 3 disks in one data center and then 3 disks in another data center that we sync it to. Those data centers are generally 400 miles apart. The reason for that is natural disasters. If, you know, something happens and California slides into the ocean, if we have what we've seen, which is flooding on the East Coast, right? What we don't want is your store, your website, your stuff to be taken down by one natural disaster. I mean, if there's a natural disaster to take out, you know, data centers that are within 400 miles of each other, I think we probably have bigger problems than our store. But you know, these are ideas, and if you're worried about that, you can put them even further apart, and you can have data centers on all the continents, and as I mentioned, in other cloud providers as well. So if we look at Azure, there's just a ton of services here, right? So we talked about the VMs, and VMs are certainly interesting to us because we have all this legacy code. But there's all kinds of software as a service. Have you guys heard of Azure SQL? A lot of people think we just spun up SQL, running on a VM, and then basically sell you access to that. It's actually not. We built Azure SQL completely separate from SQL Server. It's different. It was different code. They've merged the code bases and stuff now, but it is a software as a service SQL Server. It uses the same APIs. It didn't have all of them implemented and still doesn't have all of them. It has most of them, so most commercial software packages will run fine against it. But we've taken the same API, so it looks the same, but from a perspective of when you buy it, you say, all right, I want to have a database that can grow to this big, and I want to do this many transactions per hour, per whatever. And that's what you pay for. And so when we take your data, we can automatically shard that data and put it across multiple servers to keep that, and we do that automatically behind the scenes. You don't know how it works. You don't manage it. It just happens automatically to keep you within that SLA that you've signed up for of response time. And so that technology is being added into regular SQL for on-premises as well. But the point is it is not the same animal. It's a software as a service. Other things in there, you know, are software as a service, like HD Insight or analytics. So HD Insight is basically doing Hadoop-type clusters, big data stuff. Has anybody done Hadoop in here? How long did it take you to set up?
A while?
Yeah. I mean, you're taking about big servers that you put together. The servers we do are interconnected by InfiniBand network connections, so that's 56 gigabit throughput between interconnected between the servers at the 3 theoretical max. Those servers, huge memory, all that kind of stuff. So we can get up to 8 servers. How long do you think it takes to set up inside Azure?
Half an hour. Less.
5 minutes.
5 minutes.
You say, I want a Hadoop cluster, and then boom, 5 minutes later, you got a Hadoop cluster. And then we start to charge you, right? You get the first 2 minutes free, but after that, each minute, you got huge servers that are expensive, so we love you to use Hadoop. But the cool thing is, too, you do your data analysis, and then you turn it off, and you stop paying for it. Where when you build your own, you don't get to do that. So all kinds of neat services here. I don't know what other services I would mention, so I'll just keep going. But we keep adding new ones every day. We just made some announcements that your data that you store in here, we've got a process to keep things encrypted, right? So by default, your data on the storage is not encrypted. And you could do encryption by putting it in your data drives and doing your own encryption stuff, and you can still do that. But customers have asked for encryption aspects to encrypt data that is sitting there, so you know, even like if we got server subpoena, we couldn't give them anything but encrypted data. And like I said, you can manage that kind of stuff yourself, but we've just added a service where we've got a key vault. When your machine comes up, it passes the key to it. You can even encrypt the OS drive. So we can do encryption in the cloud with new technologies, and some of that has just shipped. Other things that are kind of nice on your VMs is from a backup perspective. We've all had to do backup, and that's the oldest thing in technology, right? Making sure you do DR. But boy, isn't it nice to be able to go onto a VM you have up on your server and just click it and say, yeah, I want this server to be backed up. That's not exactly how you do it in the portal, but all you have to do is turn it on,
And now it's going to be backing up that server automatically. And you can set policies of how often and how long the retention is and all of those things. And it's really simple. And there's no backup agent that you have to go necessarily manage. The Azure agent is there, and it does put a backup agent. But you don't have to manage it. It's really easy, really nice. And restores are easy, too. So a lot of cool things that the cloud enables. The first question I always get is about, oh, compliance. Either I can't put my data there because I have to fill, you know, this certification or et cetera. We do and fit a lot of certifications for a lot of different things, whether it's PCI compliance for credit cards or some other type of compliance. We basically take all the different compliance things and we put them into an app we bought, which basically is a simple app. It takes all that stuff and then compiles down the least common denominator out of it. So, for example, password changes. Some things say you have to change your password every 60 days. Some things say you have to change your password other numbers of days. Well, if you change it at the least, if one of them says 15 days and all of the rest are above that, you change all your passwords every 15 days, you're covered by all of them. So we are able to cover all of that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of compliance we do fit. And then as far as that compliance goes, you do have to realize just because our stuff is compliant doesn't mean what you run in there is automatically compliant. So for example, if you're a bank, you put your server there, you're taking credit cards, that's great. And then you put an admin account down there, then you set the word the password to password. You've now just failed your audit, right? You are still, you know, responsible for the things that higher up. But from the server side, from the physical security, all those things, those will be covered. And we do routine audits and all that stuff, and we can give you the documentation that you'll need for your auditors, et cetera. And the majority of where you can find all this information out is on the web. And I can give you those links. I don't know if I have them in the speaker notes here, but you can also do a Bing search, really cool search engine called Bing. It works just like Google, except it's got pictures and stuff. But you can basically do a search on, and you can search on Google as well. You can Google on Bing, because Google's a verb now. Anyway, you can definitely look at that stuff. It's interesting stuff. So what am I going to do with all this? Why do I want to do these types of things? So I want to talk real quick about what Fujitsu did, which is they had a challenge, or they saw that farmers could use some help. What they did is, using IoT and cloud, they put pedometers on cows. Okay. And then when the cow came through the gate, it read the pedometer. Because what they found was a couple of things. When cows start to go into, when female, I guess it would be a bull if it's a male, when cows go into heat, when they start to get ready to have a baby, or are fertile to be able to get pregnant, they start to walk a lot more like for the 3 days before that as they start to reach that piece. And so they're able to use that to say, all right, now's the time to breed the cow. And they're able to improve their rates. We have a 31% increase in rates of being able to produce new cows. That's the top. The average was 12%. But still, a 12% increase in yield for a farmer is 12% more profit, right? That's pretty nice. The other thing they found was they were able to tell when there were illnesses going through their herds, and by watching these steps, they're able to tell who's getting sick or that sicknesses are hitting. So they're able to save more money in that and reduce their loss. So it says here they're able to detect the 8 to 10 kinds of diseases in the cattle. Just an interesting idea with stuff that's all available to us all right now. They just had an idea of how to make things a little different. And it's kind of a neat success story. So when you think about what you can do, you know, in your businesses, in your work that you do every day, what kind of stuff can you take advantage of, deliver services faster, right? How can you use this to, you know, make yourself your nest egg? There's things that we can do, and I can talk to you more about a program called BizSpark, where if you have a startup, you may be working at GE, but you can still do a startup on the side. We will fund your startup with an MSDN account, right? And so MSDN account, that it's $14,000 a year to buy an MSDN account, right? It comes with $150 a month of Azure. It comes with all the software to do development. We just want you to develop with our stuff and use our cloud. And then when your business takes off and you're the next Facebook or the next Netflix or whatever, we want you to be our customer. And so this is a really great program. If you're interested, talk to me later, and I'll get you some pre-approval codes.
But when we look at this, how can we do this change and stuff using these technologies at your companies and your other stuff that you're currently doing? Well, if you think about it, and we talked about this earlier, it makes sense to use cloud services in that. What I would say is, as you look at these opportunities, think about how you would use these tools to do that, because these are just tools in our tool belt. There's a company that had this same challenge. They came up with an idea, and they basically wanted to do a taxi company. You know, taxi companies have been around forever. And they thought, well, what if we did taxis a little different? Because, you know, it always sucks to get in the taxi and you're going, all right, what's this guy going to do? You're watching to see if he's doing what you saw on CBS, where he's like tapping the meter and keeps going up by 50 cents. And you always wonder, what am I going to pay as I take this taxi? Boy, wouldn't it be nice to know what you're going to pay before you get in? All right, that's a great idea. What about, buying cars and all that stuff? Can we do it a way where we don't have to buy the car, where we don't have to have that investment? So a company came up with an idea. It was founded in 2009. It was launched in 2010. It's now a huge multi-million-dollar company. And all they do is a different way to do taxis. Anybody got an idea what that might be? Uber. Think about Uber. That's what Uber did. They don't own servers. They just put it in the cloud. And they make millions and millions of dollars. And it's 2016, so it's 6 years later. But wow, what a growth, right? A great idea to fix something that we've all suffered with, which is the taxi cabs, and give a better experience to customers. And if taxi cab companies had thought about this before, they wouldn't have the challenge of Uber. So that's a really neat story. They basically took this idea, took these tools, and made something nice. Another aside is Netflix. I just want to mention Netflix, because Netflix does PaaS applications, but they do it on Amazon. Amazon doesn't have a PaaS environment. So what they're doing is they built their own open source tools, which you can certainly go grab, and they built their own PaaS environment. So they use the IaaS infrastructure to run their PaaS apps on top of. And a really neat story about Netflix, for me, was the Obama administration when they ran for office in the first term. They basically had their website and stuff up on our competitor, on Amazon. And when their website was down, what do you think the network tool they first used to go find out what was going on was? They used Netflix. Netflix isn't a network tool, is it? Why would they use Netflix? Because if Netflix was down, they knew it was Amazon's problem. If Netflix was up, they knew it was their problem. They had to go do some work and fix it. Fantastic statement about how up Netflix is. Netflix even has a service called the Chaos Monkey, which goes and just whacks stuff, just goes and deletes servers, just goes and deletes services all day long, because they built this thing that would self-heal itself. It's a PaaS application that fixes itself. And it's really an interesting thing that they built. It's a lot easier to build it on somebody else's PaaS architecture than to build your own, but they've built a really neat thing. So anyway, that's what I had. Thank you for coming today.